I wanted to speak about the problem of romantic notions. Notions, it means like ideas and ideals. And it's, in other words, it's another form of false expectations, which we have talked about in the past. But it's not really like that. It's something quite different in the sense that it's part of our whole ideal of life. It's part of our whole ideal as people. You see, we had our rugs cleaned and the guy was messing around with his machine under my desk and all the wires got screwed up. And since that point, everything is a mess here. You can't imagine what a mess this room is. Thank God you can only see that backdrop. That's very good. So you have this romantic notion that this is a very calm atmosphere. I suppose TV and the movies are like that. You create these backdrops and you don't know that just on the other side of the backdrop is a complete chaos in some studio somewhere. And I present myself here with a smile and everything is fine, when it could possibly not be true. And today, definitely, it's not true. But we don't have to burden you with that. This is a time of presenting ideals. It's a time of presenting things as we wish them to be. There are many occasions in life when we are absorbed in these romantic ideals. For example, when we're very young as children, we have these great ideals of life as being very wonderful and easy, and we're protected and cared for. We have these ideals that when we grow up, everything will get better. And we have these ideals that life will be blossoming and blooming and we'll fulfill all our dreams. Then we have other ideals. I don't want to bore you with them. You know what they are when you grow up and you're a teenager and you have these ideals, romantic notions, or you have ideals about what you'll be when you get older. A romantic ideal is basically this feeling that we have that there is this better situation over there, or there's this wonderful person over there. And if I could only attain this, or I could only get together with that person, everything will be fine. Now, by the time we're about, I don't know, it's different with everybody, but between 18 and 22, this feeling of disappointment sets in very heavily. Not for everybody, but for a lot of people, we have this ideal that things should have been perfect. Or it's mainly for those who are very idealistic people. Generally, it's those who are very idealistic who end up feeling something is not right, it's not working properly, and they get very discouraged. I know I was one of them. I am also a very idealistic person. I had, especially when I was young, all these romantic notions about doing something really great. If you don't mind, I'm going to share with you some of the things from my life because I know them well. They're examples that make sense to me. And to help to clarify this idea of romantic notions. I think everybody shares the same thing. I think we all have the same kind of a way of being. And I think we have that because our spirit is like that. Our spirit does have that connection to this wonderful spiritual energy, which does fulfill all our romantic ideals. But the problem is when we are living in this world, although the same ideals are there deep within us, the manifestation of them is very difficult, or perhaps it's impossible. Now, there are some people, I don't know so many of them, but there are some people who really have fulfilled their dreams and have received all of the gifts that these dreams brought to them. But as far as I have seen, these dreams or this feeling of contentment is related to their shifting their mentality, shifting the way they think about life. Shifting means transforming. In other words, by transforming their consciousness, transforming their understanding of what they're looking for, they understand that they have already gotten it in another way. So I think my theory today will be something like, you may not fulfill your romantic notions, but you will fulfill the evolution required to accept your life in contentment. The idea being that you may not fulfill the specific romantic notion, but you might fulfill your capacity to transform, to evolve, so that you will be content in other ways. So we're going to get back to that, but I want to give some example of my own particular life, my own particular situation, so that you can see it from my point of view. Now, I don't know if my example is common. I don't know if my example is representative of everybody's example, but it's mine, so I'm sharing it. I have seen it like this, that we'll skip all the childhood stuff, but I know the first most significant thing was sports for me. I remember two things which were significant. I was very good at baseball and anything related to baseball. And in New York, there was a derivative of it called stickball, which is not, I'm not going to describe it in detail, but there was this sport called stickball. It's played against a wall where there's a box drawn on the wall and a hard rubber ball that you can throw at incredible speeds against that wall, and you have a very thin broomstick, the exact same stick you use to sweep the floor with, but without the, you cut it off, the broom, and you swing that little stick against that little ball coming in really fast. And I remember there was a period, quite some years, that I had never lost a stickball game. I was undefeated for years. Now, everybody knew this, so it became a real thing. Who's going to defeat this guy? Now, when you're a teenager, this was all during my teenage years. I don't remember what the exact ages were, but this is something really important. So it became like I became a target. That was not so bad because I actually kept on winning. But then there was one day I had a game with my best friend. And I felt kind of, I didn't feel very happy about, his name was Jay. I didn't feel very happy about this game. I was not comfortable with it. So I wasn't playing with my full heart. I was not really into it. I was just kind of hesitating, holding back. After all, he was my best friend. I mean, if I devastate my best friend in a game, how does that look? That was some idea in my deep down in the consciousness, but I wasn't totally aware of it. Well, he was also playing really good that day, and he really wanted to win. And he was also very good at it. So in American baseball, and stickball was followed the same rules, there were 9 innings. In other words, you go, he goes, you go, he goes, you go, he goes, 9 times to hit. And that could take, you know, maybe 2 hours. I mean, it's a long period of time, an hour and a half maybe. It takes a while to do all that. And if at the end of the 9 innings there's a tie, you know, like in all the other sports, then you go play a 10th inning. And if there's a tie, you go play an 11th inning. And we were going tie, 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 tie. We were in 19 innings like this, going tie, tie, tie each time. And you can't imagine how tiring this is. We're talking about 4 hours of playing. So in the top of the 19th inning, which means that, you know, he went and then I answered him, I suppose you would call it. So if he got a run and I didn't get a run, he would win. In other words, if like that. So in his hitting in the top of the 19th inning, he got two runs off of me. Two runs he got. That means over me. Two points over me, like two goals in football. So as we were switching between me pitching and him hitting, he told me, "Boy, it must be really tough for you to lose because you've never lost." And he had this smile on his face. And all my feelings of compassion for my best friend just melted away. And I didn't say a word. And I stood up on that plate and I hit three balls. He threw the ball three times. I hit them three times. And I got a single, a double, and then hit a home run. I got three runs and it was all over. And then I said something which I probably regretted for years. I walked out to him and I said, "Gee, it must be really hard to lose after coming so close to winning." Now, I maintained my undefeated status at the cost of severely damaging my relationship with my best friend. You know, I have this like warrior thing that when I'm challenged, I get into it. After this event, I was so deeply discouraged in my heart that other people started defeating me. I didn't really care, and after a while, I stopped playing totally. This same kind of a situation was there in baseball. I could have gone into the higher realms of playing baseball, but I got injured and my baseball playing career was over. And when I was around 19 years old, I had a producer in a group, actually two groups. We were going to go very far in the music industry, they said. I had, in the meantime, gotten a teaching degree. I was teaching junior high school. Everything was going very well, materially speaking. But something was wrong. I didn't feel very good about it. While I was in college, I was trying to do social reform, trying to do reformation of the way people were treating each other, reformation in the ideals of government and society. So I had these ideals of doing good, to do something substantial to transform the world. I was very idealistic. And my romantic ideals about girls were being practically broken apart by not being able to find the perfect one. So here is this person who had all of these ideals in life, who had gone and started the process of doing all kinds of things and felt that something was wrong. And along came this other ideal. Another ideal appeared before me. Now you've got to consider that when you're an idealist like this, when you have all these romantic ideals of this, how did this perfect arrangement of life, it's not something you can easily shake. Like, for example, okay, I hurt my ankle. I couldn't really play sports anymore. I could accept that. That was just a physical defect. So that I said, all right, I can't do that, but I'll do something else. And okay, can't find a proper girlfriend in this one or that one, but there'll be another one. And okay, maybe I'm not so happy in my teaching job because it's like kind of boring, but I'll do music and then it'll be fabulous. But somehow in the back of the mind, there's always this idea that it's not going to be fabulous and there is going to be something to have to work out. Don't forget, I'm what's called a nuclear baby in more senses than one. When I was young in school, in the grammar school, we used to have every week a drill what we would do if we would be bombed with atom bombs. Because, you see, the Russians had stolen the secrets of Americans' atom bomb, and America was very convinced that at any moment the whole world would be destroyed by atom bombs. So we as little children, we were like 5, 6, 7 years old, we were taught to hide under the desk when the bells started ringing with a certain pattern, because that meant there was war going on. You know, in the early 50s, the early 50s in America were filled with this paranoia of communism. So we were told that, you know, if we hid under the desk, we would be safe. Can you imagine atom bomb and we'll be safe hiding under the desk? Now, you can just imagine growing up in this atmosphere where in the back of your mind, you know very well at any moment, everybody, everywhere, all things will die. And you can also understand on my birthday of all days, in 1962, I think it was, Kennedy gets in the TV and says that, well, we could have an atom war any minute and everything could be finished because the Russians are putting missiles in Cuba and we're going to stop them. And here I am thinking, it's my birthday and I'm probably going to die. So I'm just trying to paint you a picture. Then Kennedy gets shot. Later on, his brother gets shot, Bobby Kennedy. Martin Luther King gets shot. Then Jimi Hendrix dies, and Janis Joplin dies, and all kinds of heroes die. And here I am thinking, what is really the point of all of this? So all of my idealism found a home in the Hare Krishnas. Now, you know, devotees in ISKCON at that time were such a wild bunch, you can't imagine. So it wasn't that I had an idealistic notion about them. Actually, I didn't like most of them. I thought they were all quite strange. Yet, there was chanting. There were many wonderful ideals there about loving God, serving God, loving others, being of service in the world. This made sense to me. And I felt that this would actually be a solution to the problems of the world. But then later on, I realized that this was easier said than done. You know, I even got to the point of idealizing in so many ways, different people, different things. These were romantic notions, the ideas that, well, if only it was like this, it would be just fine. But then I got into a position where I realized it wasn't going to be fine. Things were rather difficult in the 80s, for example, in ISKCON. And then I started being in the situation where others had this romantic notion about me. Now, I was very convinced that this idea of romantic notion was just impossible. It just wasn't going to be. It had to deal with these others who had the same notion. So I would try to speak in ways to get everybody to understand that this was an unrealistic idea they had. I still have this problem. Somebody wrote me about 3 days ago. They write me this letter glowing about this and glowing about that, and then being upset. This was from a person who's close to ISKCON, being upset with the way people talked about me. So I had written back saying, don't be concerned about it. They were just trying to do what they thought was right. And after all, this one person had made some good attempt. I was speaking honestly that it wasn't so bad as they thought. It was okay. And then I get a reply, oh, again, you're being so humble and only seeing the good in others. And it's just so fab. I said, oh my God, there's no hope. There's no hope. You can never be honest. You can never say anything honestly because it will always be taken within the mood of the romantic notion of others. And the dangers of these romantic notions is when when the possessor of the notion, the one who has these ideas, realizes that it's not so, they turn from being this totally committed follower to being this hateful person. You know, you've got this, I've spoken of it before, but this like ideal, Britney Spears was the ideal of the sex kitten. And when she started acting that way, everybody said, oh, she's disgusting. Obviously, I've compressed that huge problematic situation to a few sentences, and don't take that too seriously. The president of the United States was romanticized by so many people as being the savior of the conservative ideal, being the savior of the Christian ideal, the protector of the country. And now everybody who has a capacity is shooting at him for, you know, being a this or being a that and saying, I always knew it was like that. One of the more interesting concepts of this is that whenever your idealistic or romantic notion is destroyed, one of the things you say is, I always knew that. And we have to just speak badly and throw away the person as useless because they have not fulfilled our romantic ideal. Now, I have lived through such a thing, and I know that each of you have in your own particular way. We've romantically idealized parents and friends and lovers and countries and situations. And in many of those situations, we have found out it was not so. We felt cheated by it, or we felt betrayed. This is where there is a difference between false expectations and romantic notions. Now, both are false in one sense. Well, of course, what does that word mean? But both are not representative of the whole truth. Why? Because there are ways in which we cloud our vision. Our consciousness becomes clouded by conceptions. So false expectations is usually something we would use in terms of you start a business thinking you were going to have this income or that these things would be all correct, but it wasn't so. That's kind of like a false expectation, or you expected somebody to do something they didn't. It's more in the category of like managerial or structural kind of arrangements. But like these romantic notions, they bring into it not only that, but this depth of emotion, this depth of power in the way we're attached to it. And when things go in ways we don't expect, then we have like this feeling of betrayal. We have these feelings of intense agony. And then we just have this incredible anxiety. We have these incredible emotions of just these feelings pouring out in relation to that. And then we reject, and then we just get so angry, and we get so upset, and we just deal with it so violently sometimes. Or we just show our contempt by just kicking it away and walking away. Now, this kind of feeling is very difficult to deal with. I find it all the time in dealing with others. I mean, I am a great idealist, no doubt. And I, like everyone else, have romantic ideals too, expectations. But I'm also a realist. I have gone through many things in my life which made me understand the hard way that it doesn't always work that way. And while I am acting, I always try to balance. I mean, I don't succeed always, but I'm always trying to balance my romantic or my ideals with my realistic understanding of what's going on. And so therefore, I'm constantly trying to give feedback to others to have them understand the reality of the situation around me. People still ask me these like life monumental questions about solving monumental problems in their life. People still think somehow or another that they're going to get something out of me, which is going to like solve all their problems. And I keep saying it, you know, don't expect that. Why do you expect that? I may be able to help somehow or another, a little bit, but don't expect that. Can you imagine the difficulty of trying to explain to somebody that you're a person? You are a person. You've got all the same faults. You've got all the same feelings. You've got everything just like everybody else. And they just don't want to accept it. How do you explain to somebody who's asking you to solve their life, monumental life problems, when you yourself can't solve your monumental life problems? I think this has been, for me, something which has helped me understand my relationship with Prabhupada, which I think was a very significant thing in my life. And people ask me nowadays, sometimes people ask me, mainly they don't because they kind of already assume they know, but they ask me like, well, what do you think? I say, well, I don't consider him my guru or my leader, but I do love him like a father, like a friend. But not a friend like an equal friend, like a father kind of friend. I've come to understand, I'm sure he had the same kind of feelings that I'm having about people seeing me unrealistically. But the problem comes is when this unrealistic ideal people have about you fits within what you're trying to accomplish. In other words, you can use this to do something you feel should be done. So if you feel that there's some good that can come out of it, you allow it to happen. You encourage it. And you justify it and think it's fine because some really great good is going to occur. But you can't imagine what it makes you feel like when you compromise yourself like that and at the end find that great good didn't happen anyway. It's devastating. You cannot imagine it until you're in the situation, but it's devastating. So this idea of compromising yourself for an ideal is dangerous. It's risky. It's a kind of a gambling. And I think that I have to personally learn and understand and appreciate others, even those who I've loved very deeply or those who I still love in one way or another. Yet, my thing is, I don't want to use people for some ideal I have because I have learned my lesson. Yet at the same time, what do you do? I mean, how do you fulfill an ideal to do good for society, to do good for people, if you don't have the traditional means of getting something going? In other words, if you don't have like this capacity within you to allow people to romanticize you and turn you into something other than what you are as a person to accomplish something, how do you deal with it? How can we work as equals? How can we work as individuals who are independent, who are steady and strong in themselves? Yet at the same time, we do have different positions. We do have different relationships which are dependent on certain capacities that we each have. In other words, okay, in my particular case, I may not be your romantic ideal. I am definitely not your romantic ideal. Take my word for it. Yet, at the same time, I do have some capacities. Now, how do I offer those capacities and not be idealized? How can you, for example, respect or appreciate or love anybody else that you have a relationship with without idealizing that? Because as soon as we idealize another person, we are forcing them in various ways to live up to our ideal. And when we do that, two very serious things happen. The first is, at one point we realize they do not live up to our ideal, and the second point is that they become devastated by having to compromise themselves to fulfill our ideals. So I've made it very black and white. There's plenty of shades of gray in between. But human beings have this tendency to idealize others, to idealize situations, utopian ideals, we call those too. So when we idealize others, we are placing ourselves in a dangerous situation where we're going to be disappointed, we're going to be discouraged and hurt. And when we allow others to idealize ourselves, they start to modify our behavior accordingly. Because they start dealing with us as if we were this ideal, and then we start doing what they think, because we like to be an ideal. We like to be idealized. It's part of this behavioral modification that when people have a conception of us, they gradually cause us to try to fulfill their conception. Now, obviously, this is not in every single case, but it's in those cases where it's significant, so that's why I'm talking about it. And just like I'm playing stickball with my best friend, Jay, for me, all that really counted was I'm having fun with my friend. But when he started to deal with me according to this ideal, which I have somehow or another accepted of being undefeated, it transformed me. It modified my behavior towards him. And how that affected me was so deep, like, damn it, what do I care about this stupid game? I care about my friend. Sometimes we can idealize people to such an extent and modify their behavior to such an extent that we have no idea who they are anymore. I saw that with Prabhupada, I'm sorry to say. I mean, I saw him as a person, and then I saw how later on he became idealized into something that was not at all a person anymore. I saw people do that with me. I saw how I became less and less of a person and more of an image of a person who had some ideal to fulfill. And whenever I see that happening around me nowadays, I kind of push up against it. I reject it. I even sometimes feel bad about it because what I'm saying is, I'm not your ideal. And I will sometimes work completely opposite to the ideal just to convince, I guess, myself of that. For me, it's more important you know me as me. And if you do appreciate me at all, it's as me as a person. But what about you? You also are idealized by others in your life. When you get married or when you agree to be partners in any kind of endeavor, living or whatever, there's this idealism there that, yes, this is good, this feels good, because this person is something special. So the relationship is colored by this. Each of partner in this, whatever relationship it is, coloring the other with their ideals. Okay, here we're going to get really cosmic about it. People idealize God in the same way. If you think about, for example, how Krishna, for example, you read this in the Shastra, likes it much better when people deal with him as a friend or a lover or a child, because there's not that ideal there anymore. Because we have these ideas of this idealized God. And it's interesting how that idealized God doesn't like it as much to be idealized, wants to be a person. Love me for what I am, not for what I can do, or love me not for what you think I am or what this ideal is. But that's very difficult to do when you're dealing with God, when you're dealing with the Supreme. You expect so much. You expect the solution to all your problems. You expect if there's all kinds of difficulties, you pray to God, God will fix it. God will give you protection, there will be no problem. If you are good, if you are religious, you'll not lose. And because of this grand ideal, if you do lose, you say it's the mercy of God. But sometimes, very religious people wake up and say, there is no God. The most devout Jews, after everything became known, after World War II, We're faced with this dilemma that how could God allow this to happen if he exists at all? Very, very religious, devout people. Not artificially so. Honestly so. Their ideal was so devastated and so cracked, they just turned against. You know, these very intense emotions are quite similar in many respects. They're just very powerful. People have even talked about how love and hate have such a similarity to it in its depth of intensity. So I suppose the advice that I've given myself and I'm sharing with you is to not be overwhelmed by ideals. But then the problem comes, how do you live? I mean, I'm an idealist. And that's the whole struggle of this life. I am an idealist. I will always be an idealist. I am a romanticist. I'm a romantic idealist. Somehow or another, I've got to make these two, this great difficulty, work with the realistic understanding of life. I mean, in other words, hope for the best, expect the worst. Yeah, something like that. In other words, make plans to fulfill your dreams, but also make backup plans when you can't. Maybe our ideals can be simple ideals, just to somehow take care of a couple of people. A mother whose ideal is to take care of her family, it's a wonderful ideal. It's the foundation of all society. The father who has the ideal to take care of their family. A teacher's ideal to train children, or a physician's ideal to heal the sick, or whatever. We have these ideals, and they are valuable. They make life worth living for. In other words, our lives become more meaningful when we can work for something which satisfies us as people. But those kind of ideals are different than the idealism or the idealizing of other individuals. In other words, to have personal ideals that you live by and work for, that's a good thing. To idealize others, to put them in superhuman categories, is not a good thing. And therefore, it's important to see people for what they are, to accept them for what they are, and to love them for what they are, not what we want them to be. To allow them to grow, to facilitate their growth. And be of assistance rather than attempt to modify them through idealizing. Now, I feel very strongly about this, and I know it's one of those points which is, you know, it's subtle. It's subtle because it's easy to understand in the head, but when you have to deal with it face to face, it's very difficult. I mean, for example, if I were to sit today in front of Prabhupada as we knew him at that time, how would I do it? I've gone through this experiment a couple of times. Now, I know that I would put out some kind of energy to say, no, you're not my authority. Don't try to be my authority. I know I would put that out, even if I would try not to. Because we were in that position before. So one of my major thoughts would be to change that. So I would change that by saying, no, no, no. But that would be such a disturbance in the communication. It would be a huge disturbance. I mean, how do you have that energy coming out and then at the same time say, you know, I want to go to that other friendship, fatherly, loving kind of relationship was there, like, you know, when you were concerned about when I was sick or concerned about my happiness kind of thing. And how do you change that kind of relationship once, if you got together with somebody with a relationship like that of authority to the subordinate, how do you transform that later on? How do you do it? But yet it is possible. I look at my own father. My parents live very near to us. We see each other all the time. We're talking on the phone all the time. So I have a lot of experience with it. I mean, when I was young, my father was my, like, you know, ideal, this big person there, this very, you know, he knew everything, and he's an incredible person. He knows so much and can figure out so much. So he was my ideal, right? So yet now there's very much a friendship with that relationship. It's a respect, a friendship. It has transformed, and that is very healthy. But that was only possible because he's still alive. I mean, I'm still alive. The relationship was transforming over years. How do you do that with somebody who died 30 years ago? That kind of relationship is stuck to the point it was then. It couldn't evolve further in a personal kind of a way. So it stays idealized forever, or it stays repulsed, or you kind of reject it forever. In other words, there's no way to deal with it in a healthy way. But for those who have the capacity to keep modifying, to keep growing their relationship, should do so and come to this nice kind of peaceful situation where the idealism is put aside and the loving personal relationship, whatever way it will be, can manifest. You can insist on the equality that manifests from mutual love and respect and honesty and trust. That you can insist on. But some people are smarter. Some people have more capacities. Some people know how to do things or have facilities. There will always be inequality in that regard. And that we have to accept as part of what a person is. And all of this together can lead us to healthy, long-lasting, strong, and stable human relationships. And when we work together like this, we can do anything we want, and that we can all really deeply have relationships that, put it this way, really are long-lasting, stable, and realistic loving relationships. And I'm going to play music now, and I just like to really thank you all. It's for me very, very valuable that you're there, that you listen on Saturday. I mean, it's significant for me, very deeply significant. I mean, I'm an idealist, so I like to do good. I like to do things that I don't know. I like to be of service. I like to help. I like to work with others. That's my point. And this allows me to do so even though I'm here in this little tiny place. And for those of you who are economically supporting Harry Media, I just have to say I'm just so grateful for your support. I'm so grateful for your manifestation of this appreciation. I'm very grateful. And I wish you all love, and I'll see you next week.